Britain has welcomed thousands of Ukrainian refugees since the start of the war. Now many have to find more permanent homes. Affordable housing right now, not so easy.
Still no luck so far, but trying my best.
Another long-distance impact from the fighting in Ukraine, delivery of wheat got interrupted. In Senegal, where the French left behind a love of the baguette, it's a big problem. So some bread makers there are experimenting with local varieties of wheat.
We are the only bakery in Senegal using local wheat because we are the only bakery in Senegal growing local wheat.
I'm Marco Werman, and climate change worries in Iceland.
Well, if all the glaciers melt, then it's going to be a disaster, obviously.
Some good news to report, though, the blue blob to the rescue and slowing down the melt. The story is today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could make it here this Monday. The Biden White House is defending its controversial decision to send cluster munitions to Ukraine. More than two-thirds of NATO members have barred the weapons because of the threats they pose to civilians. President Biden says it was not an easy decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine, but said he's following the recommendations of the Defense Department.
This is a war relating to munitions and the running out of that ammunition, and we're low on it.
The president speaking there on CNN this weekend. We wanted to look further at what cluster munitions do and why they are controversial. For that, we turned to Mark Kansian, a retired Marine colonel. He's now a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which we note does receive corporate funding from weapons manufacturers. Colonel Kansian, first of all, the basics. Can you explain what a cluster munition is and how it works?
A cluster munition is essentially a dispenser and little bomblets. And the dispenser releases in the air above a target, and the bomblets fall to the ground, and each one of those explodes. The advantage is that it spreads the impact over a much broader area, so it's excellent for attacking what are called area targets.
And so, yeah, an area target, like what is a typical area target?
Infantry are typical area targets because infantry are very spread out. Artillery batteries also, or truck convoys would also be area targets.
Yeah, so why have so many countries banned these weapons? Where does that discomfort come from?
Well, the discomfort comes from the fact that they have high dud rates, and the dud rates can harm civilians.
What makes dud rates a problem, and do the cluster munitions from the U.S. Have that issue as well?
All cluster munitions have a dud rate problem. In fact, all munitions have a dud rate problem. Even regular artillery shells produced duds. And the duds occur because the munition doesn't land in the right way. It doesn't land on the right orientation, so it doesn't explode. The problem then, it becomes essentially a landmine. It lingers in the area and can harm civilians. That's the great concern about using cluster munitions.
Right, which is why President Biden said this was a difficult decision to make. As we mentioned, a lot of countries have straight up banned cluster munitions. How could this affect the U.S.'s image as a weapons broker? I mean, could accusations stick that this is irresponsible or even immoral?
I don't think so. First, of course, Russia will make those arguments, but of course, everybody knows that Russia's using cluster munitions quite indiscriminately. And even with our allies, some of the allies are uncomfortable, certainly. But they also recognize that Ukraine needs help. They want to support the Ukrainian resistance, and that there just aren't many great choices left. You know, given the fact that we have bad choices, in other words, there's a war going on, the Russians are deeply dug in, their continued presence in Ukraine every day causes casualties, and our stocks of artillery weapons, artillery munitions, is low. I think it was a reasonable, though very difficult, decision to make.
I mean, if we look at unexploded ordnance, I mean, it's a big problem for civilians once wars end. We've seen that in many parts of the world. The Ukrainian territory is already covered with a patchwork of landmines. Do you see unexploded cluster bomblets similar to or different from that problem?
The cluster munitions, the duds are going to add to that problem. Ukraine already has an immense problem with unexploded ordnance between regular artillery shells that haven't exploded, cluster munitions that have already been used, landmines that have been in place, to all of this by both sides. It's going to take a lot of work after the war to clean these out. Firing more cluster munitions is going to add to that, but probably only marginally. You know, it adds to a problem that's already pretty large.
Mark Hansian is a retired Marine colonel and now senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I really appreciate your insight, Mark. Thank you for talking this through.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Britain has welcomed more than 160,000 Ukrainians since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion. Many have been resettled under what's called Homes for Ukraine. For several months now, thousands of British families have hosted Ukrainians, but when those homestays come to a close, many will struggle to find a place to live. As Rebecca Rossman reports from London, some of those Ukrainians have even been forced to apply for homeless benefits.
It's amazing,
Oh, wow.
What a beautiful...
36-year-old Katerina Mishenko could not be more excited to show me the spacious English garden of her new home in Newport Pagnell, a small village just over an hour northwest of London.
It's a very good place for kids, quiet, and I just come here and go into the grass without any shoes. It's so good.
Mishenko, her husband, and two young children first settled in this area over a year ago with a host family under the British government's Homes for Ukraine scheme. The Landmark program, launched in March 2022, has matched more than 120,000 Ukrainians with UK host families who are given a £350 or nearly $450 monthly stipend in exchange for providing refugees with room and board for a minimum of 6 months. Mishenko tells me her family ended up staying with their host for nearly a year until she decided it was time for them to find a home of their own. This was last August.
They tell me, if you want, stay with us. But, you know, we are family. We want our place. We understand all this time they pay for water, for gas, for everything for us.
So Mishenko and her husband began contacting local rental agencies. They were met with silence.
No answers, nothing.
When they finally did start hearing back, they were told they needed a guarantor plus a hefty deposit, sometimes up to 6 months' rent up front. They moved into their current place in late March, 7 months after they began their housing search. And while Mishenko eventually found a happy ending, she says it wasn't thanks to help from the government, but rather a local housing charity, which agreed to act as her guarantor.
What we realised in the very early stages was there was going to be a crisis in the UK after 6 months, 9 months maybe, when people's sponsorship was coming to an end.
Derek Edwards is the co-founder of Nadia. Ukrainian for Hope, the housing charity, has helped hundreds of families find private housing in the UK by acting as their guarantors and providing interest-free loans on deposits. Edwards is proud of Nadia's work, but says local governments should be doing more to step in and assist refugees in finding private housing once their homestays end. Many don't, which is why more than 6,000 Ukrainian households are currently eligible for homelessness benefits in England alone. In some cases, Edwards accuses councils of pushing Ukrainians out of their districts so they don't have to deal with the issue. He gives the example of Milton Keynes, a city 50 miles northwest of London.
They don't want them on their books because obviously housing and the care of refugees is expensive to local government. But they have been paid, and they've been paid significant amounts by central government to actually look after these people.
In a statement, the council told the world it was working with families to help with rent, deposits, and furniture. But rents in their area are high, which is why the council sometimes recommends families look for housing elsewhere.
Okay, so some grocery shopping.
I meet Marina Plaktya, another Ukrainian refugee, in a local grocery chain called Tesco in West London. Plaktya came here with her 9-year-old son, Simon, about a year ago. Since then, they've been living with an elderly couple in South London under the Homes for Ukraine scheme. But that's coming to an end soon. And despite having a steady income, Plaktya is one of many Ukrainians in the UK who can't find an apartment.
So I've filled in the form like for those people who might be homeless in the next 50-something days.
She says the family she's been living with has been great, but they've had some recent health issues, and Plaktya agreed to find her own place by August.
Still no luck so far, but trying my best.
Derek Edwards with the charity Nadia says it's unlikely Ukrainians like Plaktya will end up living on the street, but it's a sign of a larger systemic issue.
They won't be homeless, but they will be put into some awful short-term accommodation. It's not what you should be doing when you've already escaped a war zone 6 months ago.
On top of that, Edwards says short-term emergency accommodation ends up costing the state more money. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, London.
A stunning development in the Netherlands on Friday, the Dutch government collapsed. It was triggered by Prime Minister Mark Rutte and his attempt to limit the numbers of people seeking asylum in the Netherlands. It already had one of Europe's toughest immigration policies, but the conservative prime minister wanted to go further. The Dutch government's fall is just the latest example of deep disagreements on immigration policies across Europe. Here to help us sort out what that means for Europe's future is Mujtaba Rahman. He's the managing director for Europe at the Eurasia Group. Mitch, do you think what happened to the Dutch government on Friday is unique, or is it a variation on a theme that is happening all across Europe?
I think it's a variation on a theme. I think asylum and migration policy are very difficult to manage at the European level, because they really touch on a core tenet of sovereign statehood, and that is how to guard and defend your borders. It's a tension that underpins a lot of the politics in a lot of the countries all over the EU.
In the Netherlands, asylum applications were up dramatically last year. Refugees are sleeping rough outdoors. They don't have clean water or health care. Have these conditions kind of become the new normal across Europe?
Yes, in some respects they have. The core principle of the EU's asylum policy is known as the Dublin Regulation, which effectively stipulates that migrants need to be processed in the countries they first enter. And that was meant to effectively standardize applications and prevent migrants then being shipped from one country to another. That was the objective. But in actual fact, all it did was place a tremendous amount of financial, bureaucratic, and ultimately political burden on frontline states like the Greeces and the Italies of the world. And as a result of, I think, a certain number of countries dealing with a disproportionate number of the migrants, you've seen politics in those countries move to the right and them adopt very hardline immigration policies in response. And to overcome the challenge of some of those countries bearing a disproportionate amount of the burden of the migrant challenge, the EU is effectively trying to blackmail third countries like Turkey, like Libya, like Tunisia, to help these countries process their migrants and deal with some of these challenges.
So Italy and Greece, these countries that typically encounter the migrants first, face more pressure. But, I mean, as you said, the EU sees a necessity of working together. So why does it seem national concerns are taking precedence over the goals of the European project?
There was an agreement last month on a new system that effectively stipulates that a minimum of 30,000 asylum seekers have to be relocated across the EU, and that if countries refuse to accept migrants, then they have to pay a penalty, and that sanction will then go into a pot, and that pot can be used to help produce some of the resources that countries need to help address the challenges. But as I say, there's no easy answer to the challenge in light of the numbers some of the countries are experiencing, the reluctance in other member states within the EU to accept more migrants, and the fact, as I say, the effort to try and get the Turkeys, the Libyas and the Tunisias to help, quote unquote, manage migration. A lot of money is being thrown at countries outside Europe to try and encourage them to process and deal with the migrants outside of the EU. $10.5 billion has been authorized in a recent budget proposal put forward by the EU with respect to these third countries. Whether this will ultimately work or not, I think, remains to be seen. But there is a real problem here, a structural problem in terms of the numbers, in terms of the relocation and redistribution mechanism, and whether this new attempt at an agreement can work. And as I say, the direction of politics in some of the key member states and their reluctance to accept the migrants that are coming into the EU. And right-wing populist parties are gaining ground. Many are extremely conservative on the migration question. And as a result, there isn't really the political space for a credible solution at the European level.
Mujtaba Rahman is the managing director for Europe at the Eurasia Group. He joined us from London. Midge, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Just ahead, we go to Iceland, where a blob of cold ocean water has transfixed scientists. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's known as the Blue Blob, a mysterious patch of cold water in the North Atlantic Ocean. It may just be a dot in a vast sea, but the blob has caught scientists' attention because it's bringing colder weather to Greenland and Iceland, and that has slowed down glacial melt, at least temporarily. The World's Jerry Haddon has our story from the Longyearbyen Glacier, one of the largest in Iceland.
On the drive up to Longyearbyen, the ice looks like a great white wave floating between sky and earth. Immense, immaculate, mesmerizing. My spell's broken by a tour bus speeding past along the rough volcanic track. This glacier draws tens of thousands of visitors a year. Like the Shah and Chakor families visiting from South Carolina. They're originally from northern India, they tell me, near the Himalayas, so they say they know the importance of glaciers.
Well, if all the glaciers melt, then it's going to be disaster, obviously.
The glacier is a natural beauty, too, so, yeah.
The glaciers start melting, the whole world will be underwater.
In fact, Iceland's glaciers began melting a long time ago, at least as far back as 1890, when ice melt was first measured. From then, through 2019, Longyearbyen lost 29% of its mass. But there may be a glimmer of hope for this region, the so-called Blue Blob, an area of ocean water more than 1 degree cooler than the North Atlantic average. That might not sound like a lot, says glaciologist Tolli Avenskindottir, but it matters, because the cold water is lowering air temperatures here on land.
From 1995 to 2010, we had about a meter of thickness of the glacier disappearing every year. And after 2010, at the same time as this blue blob was appearing, this rate of mass loss actually decreased.
By about half, she says.
So we see that the glaciers actually sense this cooling effect of this blue blob.
People in Iceland sense the cooling as well. At a camping store in the capital, Reykjavik, salesman Johannes Johannesson says his clients are shopping as if it were still March.
Yeah, we see a rise in buying warmer clothes later in the year. It's June, and people are still buying jackets and warmer clothes.
Have you heard of this thing called the blue blob, by chance?
No, never.
Scientists know little about where the blue blob came from, says glaciologist Avenskindottir, but she says scientific modeling suggests it will hang around for a while.
This is like a regional North Atlantic effect, that it slows down the mass loss of the Icelandic glaciers until about 2050, and after that it picks up again.
Avenskindottir stresses that the blue blob isn't halting glacial melt, just slowing the rate of loss.
All the glaciers in the world are losing mass, and they are really telling us the story of warming climate. So we can see those giants, if you like, if you call the glaciers giants, they are really retreating.
Back at the Longyearbyen Glacier, guide Christian Eli Gunnarsson has seen the retreat of the giants firsthand. Since 2020, he says, this glacier has retreated a full mile, leaving just a rocky plain behind. In fact, across that vast plain, they've put up a bunch of metal signposts marking the years, 1940, 1960, 1980, showing where the ice once was. It's a timeline of loss, and it's accelerating.
The distance between the 1940 sign and the 1960 sign is the same distance as we have from the 2020 sign to today. So it's 10 times faster, which is ridiculous, basically.
About 10% of Iceland is still covered by glaciers, what Icelanders call their white diamonds. Gunnarsson wonders how much time the blue blob is really buying them. These days, he says, when he takes groups up on the ice.
It's like walking in wet sugar.
Gunnarsson says he's worried he'll be out of work soon. Tourists, he says, aren't likely to come for a slog through the slush. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Longyearbyen Glacier, Iceland.
It was a problem even before the pandemic hit, and the healthcare industry is still struggling with major staffing shortages, in large part because foreign nurses are not able to get green cards to come work here in the United States. Hospitals, nursing homes, and other healthcare facilities have relied on nurses from abroad to fill important jobs. To help us understand what's going on, we reached out to Erica DeBoer in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. She's the chief nursing officer at Sanford Health, the largest rural health system in the U.S. Erica, when the U.S. medical system urgently needs nurses, why is there this holdup on green cards for nurses from overseas?
Well, interestingly enough, the immigration quota hasn't changed since 1990. And so in all actuality, this has been a challenge with visas for some time. Obviously, with the workforce shortages that we're seeing in nursing and across other workforces, changing some of that quota is what's really important to try to address some of the needs to meet the care needs of our patients.
So paint the picture for us with an organization like Sanford, where you work. What is the impact of the staffing shortage?
Great question. So we actually embarked on this journey to hire internationally trained nurses over 3 years ago now. So this is not a short-term solution. It's really a long-term solution for us. We actually intend to hire over 800 internationally trained nurses over the next 2 to 3 years. So the specific impact to us based on the retrogression and some of the delays that the visa limitations are going to offer to us means that about 160 nurses that have accepted roles to work with Sanford have delayed arrivals, which means they may not be able to join our team until next year.
What is your sense of conditions overall? Like, how much of a challenge is this nursing shortage for the U.S. healthcare industry as a whole?
So nursing workforce has been a challenge for years. We've known about this for 20 years. I think what happened with COVID specifically is it expedited some retirements. We have seen a lot of our nursing workforce leaving the profession. So our internationally trained nurses and that strategy that we put in place has been a really important thing for us to stabilize our workforce and make sure we can continue to care for our complex patients.
Just how reliant is the U.S. on foreign nurses at this point, and why and when did the U.S. become more dependent on nurses from abroad?
We've actually had internationally trained nurses across the nation for many years, so it's not something that's really new to us. I think we've become more dependent on our internationally trained nurses, knowing that our colleges of nursing don't necessarily have even enough seats in their colleges to actually support the workforce needs of the future. When we look ahead, just 3 to 5 years down the road, we'll be short about 3.5 million nurses.
Erica, how much visibility do you have into the process in Washington that could possibly break the logjam on these visas?
We have a fairly strong voice in a couple of the different acts that are actively going on. The Dignity Act specifically that's in Congress right now would actually improve the visa processing. And then more importantly, when we think about reintroducing the Healthcare Workforce Resiliency Act, that would help us actually recapture some of the unused visas from previous fiscal years to help with some of that.
Any hope soon that lawmakers in Washington can break the logjam on visas for foreign nurses? And what's your concern if lawmakers can't? Because it seems to be caught up in politics at the moment.
There is a lot of politics right now. And I do have concerns that if we don't expedite some of this, that there will be additional strategies that we'll have to put in place to try to help mitigate the risk of our workforce not being available to take care of patients.
Erica DeBoer is the Chief Nursing Officer Sanford Health in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, speaking with us about the backlog in green cards for international nurses hoping to come work here in the U.S. Erica, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We'll be right back with more for you in the next half hour of the show. You're listening to The World. Hong Kong is clamping down harder on 8 pro-democracy activists who left the territory, offering cash rewards for information that can lead to their arrest. We speak with one of them who says she will be more cautious now.
At the same time, I'm not going to back down. I'm not going to be quiet or silence myself just because of the bounty.
Remaining defiant under pressure, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The war in Ukraine has disrupted many parts of the global economy. West Africa has been hit, like much of the globe, by interruptions in the delivery of wheat. And as The World's TV Saizea reports from Dakar, that has shaken up a big part of Senegalese culture.
It's 8 in the morning, and I'm about to enter a small but pretty busy bakery in a poor neighborhood in Dakar, the capital of Senegal. About a dozen clients are waiting behind the counter, and they all want to get one thing.
One baguette.
French baguette. That's by far the most popular product sold in this bakery. The owner, Alioune Thiam, says he sells about 1,000 baguettes every day.
I'm Senegalese, and we were colonized by French, and they introduced the French baguette. That's why we got habit to eat French baguette every single day. I love it.
In bakeries and street markets, even gas stations, 10 million baguettes are sold every day in this country of 17 million people. Sometimes it's breakfast with a layer of chocolate. Or it's a sandwich filled with sardines or meat for lunch, or just bread with water in the country's poorest areas. Aminia Sal, a customer at the bakery, says she's been eating bread since she was a baby. She speaks Wolof, the local language, and our producer translates.
The weaning process after breastfeeding includes bread, includes writing some Quranic verses on the bread itself and dipping it in some liquid milk and giving it to the child. And as soon as they eat it, it is said that the child will automatically, mystically forget that mom has a breast and will not go after that.
And does it work?
It works.
But the love with the French baguette has been threatened by a war happening thousands of miles away. Senegal imports wheat primarily from Russia. Claude Demba Diop is the president of the National Association of Grain Importers in Senegal.
Dans la mesure où dès qu'il y a un phénomène de rareté,
he says when the war started in February of last year, Russian shipments stopped because of the sanctions and the grain prices increased.
On a eu de nouvelles destinations, la Pologne, la Lituanie.
Diop says importers had to get wheat from other countries such as Poland, Lithuania, France, or Argentina. But those were more expensive. The government froze the price of bread for consumers and promised importers it would make up the difference in cost, but it has yet to do so. Demba Diop says earlier this year, Senegal was able to resume most of the imports coming from Russia and prices are slowly returning to normal. But the crisis helped raise awareness about the risks of being 100% dependent on wheat imports.
We can't keep on living like this. We have to find our own solutions, our own ways to be self-sufficient and to be independent.
That's Mohamed Mustafa, the owner of a bakery in Dakar that sells bread made out of domestic wheat.
We are the only bakery in Senegal using local wheat because we are the only bakery in Senegal growing local wheat.
Wheat doesn't normally grow in tropical climates like in Senegal, but researchers have been trying out seeds that can withstand heat. Amadou Titian Sall is with the Institute of Agricultural Research in Senegal.
Alors, toutes les variétés développées partout dans le monde.
He says these seeds have already been successfully introduced in Mali and Egypt. But while the bread made from this wheat is more nutritious, it's not quite the same as a traditional French baguette. The color and the texture are different. It looks more like whole wheat bread. As for the taste,
okay, so this is the baguette made out of Senegalese wheat. It's good. It's delicious.
But it didn't taste like French baguette. It tasted the way it looked, like whole wheat bread. But that doesn't bother baker Mohamed Mustafa.
I'll take the chance to show you guys. This is the wheat that we grow here. All these seeds that you guys see here are Senegalese wheat seeds. And we know that we can make anything we want to make with this local Senegalese wheat. We just have to believe in it.
Senegal has tried to reduce the dependence on grain imports for years, but Mustafa says it's been challenging.
The war in Ukraine made it more of a reality.
He says now there is a sense of urgency to solve the problem. Earlier this year, the government imposed new requirements to help local producers of grain. Corn, millet, and some other grains are grown in Senegal. By 2025, at least 20% of these domestic products must be incorporated in the bread-making process. Mohamed Mustafa is already doing that. But the question remains if people will like the change. Back in his bakery, I ask a customer if he's tried non-traditional baguettes made with local grains.
Si j'ai mangé le pain de mie, le pain de maïs, j'ai goûté un peu.
So he says, I've tried the millet bread and I also tried the corn bread, but the taste is different. It's still kind of heavy, so he prefers the wheat bread over the other types of bread.
By wheat bread, he means the traditional French baguette. The biggest challenge to grain independence in Senegal may prove to be changing people's habits. For the world, I'm Tibisay Zea, Dakar, Senegal.
When large-scale pro-democracy demonstrations broke out in Hong Kong in 2019, many leaders of the movement were quickly forced into hiding away from the territory. Now authorities are tightening the screws. Hong Kong's police department is offering cash rewards for information leading to the capture of 8 activists. They're wanted for, quote, endangering national security. Anna Kwok is one of those activists. She joins us from Washington, where she's the executive director of the U.S.-based nonprofit Hong Kong Democracy Council. Anna Kwok, you now have a bounty on your head for more than $100,000. What was your reaction when you heard this?
So after, you know, being shocked for a second about their stupid action, I immediately seized the opportunity to talk about Hong Kong, because right now you can really see the transnational repression conducted by the Hong Kong government. And they have absolutely no regard for international treaties, boundaries, and also the safety of people overseas. But still, there's this, you know, a very blatant act of transnational repression conducted by the government. And there's no bounds to what they're doing.
So the Hong Kong authorities are offering 1 million Hong Kong dollars. That's $128,000 for the information leading to the arrest of you and 7 other activists. Is your understanding of this bounty, this cash reward, is that it's for your return to Hong Kong or for information that would let officials in Hong Kong know of your whereabouts?
To my understanding, it's for me to return to Hong Kong, but also if anyone can provide, you know, substantial information about where I am and things like that, you know, that can really harm my personal safety, I believe they may get the cash reward as well. But that is something I'm not entirely sure. But, you know, in my opinion, the Hong Kong government has been asking us to return to Hong Kong. But I think it's really a publicity stunt from their end to try to intimidate people, because even though the bounty was placed on the 8 of us, I think is actually placed on the 8 networks supporting each of us, and that they're adding to the cost of people who have remained anonymous thus far for them to continue their work. And that is really what at play here.
I mean, in the minds of authorities in Hong Kong, do they see one scenario here that you could be, you, for example, could be detained in Washington and taken back to Hong Kong or Beijing? I mean, how would that even work?
I mean, of course, they would ask international governments to cooperate. But I think they are also very clear that, for example, the U.S. government would not do anything like that, for example.
So, Anna Kwok, how does this change things for you? Will you operate differently?
Of course, I would be more cautious and careful about where I am, what I'm doing. But at the same time, I'm not going to back down. I'm not going to be quiet or silence myself just because of the bounty. And for what it's worth, I think the bounty kind of affirms the work I'm doing. For example, I've been campaigning for not having John Lee, the sanctioned chief executive of Hong Kong, set foot in America for the APEC meeting this November. And the same goes for a recent report release we had on the Hong Kong government's lobbying activities here in the U.S. And these type of stuff are the things that caused me to have the bounty placed on my head.
So the Chinese security law, as we know, has been enacted. Pro-democracy demonstrations have certainly died down, but I'm guessing the desire for freedom for many Hong Kongers is still alive. What is the state of the pro-democracy movement inside Hong Kong today?
So for Hong Kongers who are inside of Hong Kong, they're still trying to find ways whenever possible to show dissent and to tell the world that they have not succumbed to the draconian crackdown by the Hong Kong government. For example, on June 4th, on June 12th, and on July 1st, we have seen Hong Kongers went to the streets to chant slogans, even though they got arrested immediately within seconds. But then, of course, we know the stake is very high. And right now, there are more than 1,500 political prisoners in Hong Kong. And there are going to be more, because we can see there are trials that will be finished, you know, within this year. For example, the NSL 47 trial and the Jimmy Lai case. There are many cases we can see happening down the road. And Hong Kongers are really worried that we'll be forgotten by the world.
Do you know what the condition of those hundreds of prisoners inside Hong Kong is?
So the 1,500 political prisoners in Hong Kong are obviously in jail. And part of being in jail is that some of them are being put through so-called de-radicalization program. And what that essentially is a sort of brainstorming mechanism for them to be in touch with so-called patriotic values. So the conditions are bad, I think, both physically and mentally. And really, it's a kind of psychological torture, I think, to repeatedly brainwash something into someone's mind and also rejecting someone's identity from the core.
Anna Kwok is wanted by the Hong Kong police for violating a strict national security law. She's executive director of the U.S.-based nonprofit Hong Kong Democracy Council and spoke with us from Washington. Anna, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's estimated that there are 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States. Among them are many who were brought to this country from Mexico as children. They attended American high schools and dream about going to college. But access to higher education is more difficult for undocumented students because they don't qualify for federal financial aid. One institution that did serve many undocumented students in Milwaukee has now closed its doors for good. Emily Files from WUWM reports on Cardinal Stritch University, seen as a welcoming place for people facing those additional barriers.
Sinai Mendoza always knew she wanted to go to college.
I remember I had like a picture of Harper right in my locker my freshman year because I was like, that was like inspiration, right? Like, I'm going to make it to college.
As an undocumented immigrant, Mendoza wasn't eligible for federal loans or grants. She also wasn't eligible for in-state tuition at University of Wisconsin schools.
So I know from my end, I have to be able to get a scholarship that would support me through my 4 years of college. And Stritch did that.
Out of all the schools Mendoza applied to, Cardinal Stritch University offered her the most aid. It's something you hear from other undocumented students as well. The private Catholic university was the most affordable option in the state because of the level of institutional aid it offered them. Marilyn Jones, an assistant professor of Spanish at Stritch, says it's a reflection of the school living out its Franciscan values.
If I can say something about Stritch, is that we embraced our mission to serve the underserved. A lot of people there really embraced that mission. They saw that this was everybody's responsibility to help our students first feel like they were welcome, they were valued for who they were.
As a faculty member at Stritch, Jones helped Mendoza and other students form a club in 2017 called Dreamers Welcome. Mendoza says it came at a time of great uncertainty for the community.
It was a pretty rough year just because Trump had gotten elected. So there was a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric, right, going on. And my friend Laura and Rosa Isela and myself, we decided that we wanted to start an organization for undocumented and documented students on campus.
Dreamers Welcome not only supported students, it helped educate faculty and staff about legal and other challenges undocumented students face. Mendoza graduated from Stritch in 2018, but Dreamers Welcome continued. Its last president was 20-year-old Maria Perez, who just finished her sophomore year.
Once I heard that Dreamers Welcome was something a part of Stritch, I felt safe. Like, I felt like immediately safe.
Perez is one of about 30 undocumented students who were attending Stritch this past spring. Her family migrated from Mexico when she was a child. She had to figure out college on her own.
I remember one time my dad told me, I'm not going to be able to pay for your education. So when he told me that, it was like, okay, should I even go through with it? You know, I have good grades, but how far can that get me?
Perez didn't need to worry. She received a full-ride scholarship to Stritch. She lived on campus and studied clinical psychology. Then, in April, Perez was at a Starbucks studying for exams when she found out Stritch would close at the end of the semester.
I went into my car, and I just cried because it didn't feel real. It felt like a dream, and I just kept crying because I didn't know where my education was going to stand.
Stritch shut its doors because of steep enrollment declines, which led to financial problems. Here's President Dan Scholz.
In the end, we felt like we had to maintain Stritch's quality education. And if we can't do that, we felt like we couldn't, in good faith, keep going forward.
The about 1,000 students attending Stritch have scrambled to transfer schools. Maria Perez will attend Mount Mary University, another Milwaukee Catholic university that's matching her financial aid. Sinai Mendoza, the Stritch alum, is sad that future undocumented students won't be able to attend her alma mater.
I'm still thinking about future generations and future students who were probably hopeful that Stritch was going to take them in, and probably that's not possible anymore.
Mendoza says the values Stritch instilled in students, including serving the underserved, will live on with them. For The World, I'm Emily Files in Milwaukee.
It is hard in the heat many of us are experiencing to imagine how art could change things. But in Venezuela, one artist is tackling climate change by brightening up neighborhoods throughout the country with bottle caps. Oscar Olivares, a visual artist from Caracas, has been creating large-scale multicolored frescoes from the plastic bottle tubs that people throw away. From a distance, his wall-sized art looks like bright and intricate tile work. Moving closer, and you see that each point of color is an individual bottle cap. My colleague Carol Hills recently spoke with him.
Oscar, you started your career as an illustrator. Were you already interested in bottle caps as a way to make art?
Well, it was a mixture of a lot of things. I received a proposal of a municipality in Caracas that is El Atillo. They had a lot of bottle caps they had collected, but they didn't know what to do with them. They wanted to make something with art, but they didn't know anything about what could be done with that. They told me about that. At the first moment, I was thinking about it, but, you know, I wasn't too much interested in the project until I went to this museum in France. At the first moment, I thought we were going to make just one mural. When I came back to Caracas, I just took a lot of bottle caps, threw them in the floor, and I said, if I can make an eye, we can make everything with bottle caps. This is a kind of art that when you are very close to it, you just see the bottle caps, all the brands, some bottle caps very ugly or very dirty because they come from the trash, you know. But when you walk a few steps far from the mural, you can see all the art. So it was a result of a proposal from this municipality, but also because of this visit to the museum that changed my mind about it.
So walk us through the process of planning a mural. How do you know how many bottle caps you'll need, how many different colors, and how do you design them?
The first I need is the size of the wall. With the size of the wall, I know how many bottle caps I'm going to need, because in 1 square meter, you need 1,100 bottle caps. With that, I began to make the design of the mural. And in the design, I have to think what kind of colors I'm going to find. Because, for example, in Venezuela, you can find more than 16 different tones of blue. That's not common in other countries. For example, in Mexico, you will find more tones of green.
Now, one of your murals, you say, is the largest eco-mural in the world, and it's made completely out of bottle caps. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's a mural that is in Guatire in Caracas, and it has more than 400,000 bottle caps. In 3 months, the community of Guatire recollected more than 1 million bottle caps for this mural. So we have even bottle caps for more projects in the future, and it was an amazing experience. I thought it was going to take us more than 3 months, but the people was so willing to help us that it just took us 33 days, something like that. In just one day, we had like more than 100 people volunteering to help us in the mural.
So what is the design? What is the mural of?
Yes. In this mural of Guatire, we have a lot of things because it's very large. It's 90 meters long. And we have the Parranda of San Pedro. There is some people dancing with flags and colors. Then we have four macaws. That is a very beautiful beard with a lot of colors, red colors. That is very typical in Venezuela, also Brazil, Colombia, in the Amazonia in general. After that, we have the Turpial. That is the national beard of Venezuela. We have a landscape of the mountains of Ouattire. And at the end of the mural, there is the planet Earth. Because I think that this kind of art is not just something for Venezuela or for the cities who are making it, but for the world.
You know, in the U.S., when people recycle bottles, they tend to throw out the bottle caps. So I'm wondering, A, is that the case in Venezuela? And is your art to kind of a way to tell people, no, don't throw out those bottle caps, save them, and we're going to use them for art?
Yes, yes. It's very interesting because in Venezuela, there are very few policies about recycling, very few information about how to recycle. There is a lot of people that wants to recycle more, but they don't know how to do it. And the murals have been a very good way to collect the bottle caps in every place we go. For example, there have been murals in Caracas, and there is people from another state, and they send the bottle caps to help us in the mural.
So do you have any future eco murals planned?
Well, yes, yes. And well, it's very interesting and very exciting because I have the plan to make the first eco mural in the U.S. very soon. I'm going to announce very soon. And we have also plans to make some in Panama, in Italy, and a lot of more in Venezuela. I think the most special is that it's not made just by an artist. It's by the people that collect the bottle caps, that is really taking consciousness about the earth and about the recycling.
Oscar Olivares is a visual artist based in Venezuela. He's using ecological art to brighten up Caracas, Venezuela. Thank you for joining us, Oscar.
Thanks to you. Thanks to you.
The colors and patterns of Oscar Olivares' creations are as mesmerizing as they are fun. We've got photos for you on our website. Check them out at theworld.org. The Colombian telenovela Yo Soy Betty La Fea, or I Am Betty, the Ugly One, is one of the most successful TV shows produced in Latin America. It's been adapted more than a dozen times, including the U.S. version, Ugly Betty. The original ended in 2001, but it's coming back next year for a reboot on Amazon in the original Spanish with Betty, 20 years older and wiser. In the U.S. version, the theme song was instrumental and brief, getting us right into the action. Then there's the original Colombian version. Its theme song offers up the whole Betty backstory, starting with the birth of the baby girl and the grimaces on her parents' faces when she enters the world, right into a tango recounting the hardship of not being a glamour queen. Se Dice de Mi, or It Is Said of Me, sung by Colombian actress and vocalist Yolanda Reo, is brutally and comically honest. In the upcoming reboot of Yo Soy Betty La Fea, Betty is a mother and a successful businesswoman. She's also facing a dire economy, which, given what we're currently witnessing, may end up being the ugliest part of the new series. Yo sé que hay muchos que desprecian con mentiras y suspiran y se mueren cuando piensan en mi amor. Y más de uno se derrite si suspiro y se quedan si los miro resoplando con temor. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Yo soy así. Y ocultan de mí.